Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to episode 68, season 3. I'm going to talk about something that was huge at the time, was American revivalism. To bring back the colonial revival style in America. The colonial revival is so prevalent in the United States that it is often quite overlooked. Hidden. In a sense, in plain sight, it has been given high and low interpretations by the nation's most talented architects and by budget restaurant chains. It has been promoted by our leading cultural institutions and sold by department stores. It has enjoyed periods of favor and disfavor, but seems to never entirely disappear. Indeed, we seem to have revived our colonial revival past practically the moment it officially ended in 1776. The architectural historian Richard Wilson points out, for example, that the iconic steeple of Philadelphia's Independence Hall, which was added in 1828, is an example of the colonial revival. That the addition came so closely on the heels of the colonial period itself underscores that the style is less a revival than of an ancient tradition. Like the Gothic revival, then, it is an ongoing part of our identity. In a still young nation of immigrants, the colonial revival is an aesthetic expression of our constant need for, as the historian Henry Steele Commoner so trenchantly put it, a usable past that gets used well. The colonial revival's longevity and continuing vitality are not, however, merely byproducts of a search for a collective identity. The style responds to a wide variety of agendas, from that of the person who traces his or her roots to the colonial period and wishes to assert the power of legacy to the hyphenated American, Irish American, Italian American, Polish Americans, for examples, for whom the style might express a sought-after sense of security of belonging in a new place. For the aesthetically traditional, the styles offer a reliable choice associated with taste and restraint. For the more adventurous, the colonial revival, with its legible lexicon of shapes and proportions, serves as a jumping-off point for invention or whimsy. Given the style's openness to interpretation and variation, it is not surprising that throughout its history it has been creatively shaped and disseminated by key individuals. In addition to high-style architects and designers, this list includes surprising figures from a minister-turned-entrepreneur to a Lithuanian-born craftsman to a first lady. So let's talk about them here. So some of the pioneers, McKim, Mead, and White. A major watershed in the evolution of the colonial revival occurred in 1877, when four young architects, Charles McKim, William Mead, William Bigelow, and Stanford White, toured New England, sketching and measuring historic colonial-era houses in Marblehead, Newburyport, and Salem, Massachusetts, as well as in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And these are all great places to go, believe me, I've been there many times. But even before this joint effort, McKim had visited and sketched colonial buildings for years on his own in Newport, Rhode Island. In the process, a new direction in American architecture was forged. The firm of McKim, Mead, and White was established in New York in 1879. And 3 years later, the architects began to design the H.A.C. Taylor House in Newport, completed in 1886. The house was a pioneering example of the colonial revival era. McKim, Mead, and White followed the earliest foray into colonial revival with the Mount Vernon-inspired James L. Breeze House on Long Island, as well as numerous other residences in New York City. So let's talk about the populist, Wallace Nutting. Had many of his editions of the Furniture Dictionary. It's actually the Furniture Bible, as far as I'm concerned, editions 1, 2, and 3. So a former minister, Wallace Nutting, succinctly summed up his aesthetic philosophy. Not all old is good, but all the new is bad. He started taking photographs of American countryside around 1900. And by 1904, he opened the Wallace Nutting Art Print Studio in New York, where he sold the images. For nearly three decades, Nutting pursued numerous colonial revival projects. He bought colonial houses and opened them up for tourists. He staged and photographed period-appropriate tableaux, employed hundreds of colorists to hand-paint the photographs, and sold them nationwide as decorative accents. Beginning in 1917, Nutting fabricated reproductions of 17th and 18th century American furniture. He also wrote extensively about his passion. In 1928, the two-volume of the Furniture Treasury, with 5,000 photographs, all taken by Nutting himself, is still considered an invaluable pictorial guide to the furniture of the nation's early years. And let me tell you, it is absolutely indispensable. I've been looking at that for almost 40 years. So the sophistique, Mott B. Smith. So in 1920, after several years of working primitively on house renovations, Mott Smith began to collaborate with the celebrated interior decorator, Elsie DeWolf, on a series of projects that would establish him as both a significant architect and a practitioner sought after by members of New York's social elite. Schmidt's design of three townhouses on Midtown Manhattan's Avenue, A, for Elizabeth Marby and Tracy Morgan and Anne Vanderbilt, helped to create the stylish enclave known as Sutton Place. Decades later, his 1966 addition to Gracie Mansion, the late 18th century farmhouse that serves as New York City's official mayoral residence, capped his career as an accomplice historicist architect. His alliance to American traditional and British precedents, however, had positioned him largely outside the mainstream of a profession in the thrall of modernism. Schmidt died in 1977, just as a younger generation of architects was training an appreciation for a wide spectrum of traditional architectural vocabularies. So let's talk about a collector, and which is Henry Francis DuPont, and his designer, Henry Davis Sleeper. But I must say again, which I've said before, Henry Francis DuPont may have been a collector out of greed and ego to show everybody what his money could buy, but he raped countless houses throughout colonial America, and the remnants still. I've heard stories of three or four houses where he sent his minions out to rip out interior moldings and fire surrounds and things like that, and the locals actually started shooting and threatening to kill the workers. So he's not all he's cracked up to be, nor his rendition of Winter Tour. But we'll deal with that at a later time. Henry Francis DuPont was one of the greatest collectors of Americana during the 20th century, and his two houses in Chestertown and Winter Tour were the focus of his efforts. In 1924, DuPont commissioned the New York architecture firm Cross and Cross to design Chestertown in Southampton, Long Island. To create the interiors of the 50-room house, DuPont turned to the designer Henry Davis Sleeper, whose own house, Beauport in Gloucester, Massachusetts, DuPont highly admired. "Might it be fun," Sleeper had asked, "to have a house with which each room could recapture some of the spirit of a specific mood or phrase or even a period of our American life from the time of Plymouth down through the Revolution or early Republic?" Sleeper's favorite room in the house was a New England-style colonial kitchen named the Pembroke Room after the Massachusetts town, where Robert Baker, an ancestor, had built a saltbox cottage in 1650. So after working with Sleeper on Chestertown, DuPont turned his attention to Winterthur, a far grander estate outside of Wilmington, Delaware. The DuPont family had purchased the estate in the early 19th century, but in 1930, Henry DuPont had inherited it 3 years earlier, established the nonprofit educational Winterthur Corporation with the express purpose of transforming the house into a museum devoted to early American decorative arts. And by 1932, he had doubled the size of the building to accommodate his collections. And in 1951, he opened the house museum finally to the public. Let's talk about the subordinate, Royal Barry Wills. So during the post-World War II era, Royal Barry Wills was arguably the nation's most popular architect specializing in single-family houses. In 1925, Wills opened his own architectural office in Boston, and by the mid-1930s had specialized in the design of houses for a middle-class clientele in the post-war era. With the resurgence of home building industry, he was perfectly positioned to become a leader in the field. The editors of Life stated that he designed the kind of house that most Americans want. His work evolved from simpler schemes for smaller houses to large-scale, full-blown essays in the Colonial Revival style, complete with cobblestone-paved driveways. He freely interpreted such features as a covered wing connecting a typical New England farmhouse to a barn, rendering it as a kitchen and laundry room linking the core of the house to a two-car garage. Though often dismissed by members of the architectural profession, Wills was widely published in the popular press and enjoyed enormous success. By the time of his death, his firm had completed more than 2,500 house projects. Let's talk about Colonial Revival, the patriot, Eleanor Roosevelt. On May 16, 1727, Eleanor Roosevelt, soon to be First Lady of New York State and eventually the nation, opened her East Side townhouse to a public viewing of reproductions of 18th-century American furnishings by Val Kill Industries, founded in 1926 by Mrs. Roosevelt and three friends, Nancy Cook, Marion Dickerson, and Carolyn O'Day. This enterprise was located near the main Roosevelt family house in Hyde Park, New York. Until the operation closed in 1936, Val Kill employees produced replicas of early American furniture, pewter, weavings, many of them reproductions of pieces in museums. Val Kill products were carried by leading department stores and specialty shops in various American cities. As the depths of the Great Depression, Roosevelt linked the nation's legacy of colonial-era architecture and decorative arts to national unity and triumph over adversity. In reference to the bicentennial of George Washington's birth in 1932, which was marked by celebrations centered on full-scale reconstruction of Federal Hall in Manhattan's Bryant Park and Mount Vernon's in Brooklyn Prospect Park, Roosevelt asserted that it was good for all of us in the trying times we were going through to consider those early days when the problems were probably even greater and learn the lessons which the characters of the men who found the United States have to teach us, putting it out there. So now we're going to talk about the new traditionalist in Colonial Revival. So after World War II, a stylistic split developed. Colonial Revival largely disappeared from the urban scene. While it remained popular, although often watered down in the surrounding suburbs, the bicentennial 1976 sparked interest in the nation's past, just as a centennial had a century before. Alan Greenberg and Robert Stern were among the first high-profile architects to reconnect with the rich traditions of the Colonial Revival. Greenberg's grandly evocative Mount Vernon-inspired Connecticut farmhouse of 1983 garnered broad attention. 3 years later, Stern had already been pursuing a variety of classically rooted architectural styles, hosted a documentary television series, Pride in Place, Building the American Dream, that explored the nation's architectural heritage and its continued relevance in its place in the world. So a younger generation of architects has followed in the footsteps of Greenberg and Stern. Peter Pennoyer worked as Robert A. Stern Architects before opening his own firm. He also collaborated a series of books on important American architects working in classical styles, such as Delano and Aldrich. Ann Fairfax and Richard Simmons established their architectural practice in 1992. Gil P. Schaefer III started his firm, Gil P. Schaefer Architect, in 2002, having previously worked for Pennoyer. While decorative artists and interior designers have consistently embraced the colonial revival era, some of today's practitioners are mining the style in particularly inventive ways. James Boyd and Anne Reth have packed up the colonial tradition of using silhouetted forms of wallpaper, representing unexpected figures. So during a weekend at the museum, the artists surveyed a vast collection and each selected one artifact they found inspiring from going back to the 18th century. So one was a Muhlenberg chandelier that was sparkled by a colonial-era lighting device in the museum's Prentice House. A New York City interior done by William Diamond and Anthony Barretta in 1999 is a psychedelic update of colonial revival with braided rugs reminiscent of Wallace Nutting, but here rendered 60 feet long and colored with acid green and shocking pink. Manhattan decorator Jeffrey Billhauer's recent renovation in a 17th century Long Island house, which he christened Hay Fever, artfully mixes furnishings and decorative effects from numerous periods, including the colonial, while Jamie Drake's interiors for Gracie Mansion constitute a bold essay of the colonial revival for the 21st century. So in the hands of talented practitioners, the colonial revival is at once instantly recognizable and sufficiently malleable as to be continually reimagined, retaining its status as the only real American style. Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing off. Thanks, everyone, for listening.